and it is on the topic of historical materialism. And I think we can go through this a little bit more quickly than we did the earlier material. There we go. So first of all, what are the main assumptions of historical materialism? You can start in a couple of different places, but Marx basically starts with the situation of the typical human being. And his point is that human beings are themselves material organisms, and so they have needs of nutrition, shelter, clothing, water, and so forth. And a second premise, not listed here, but obviously true, human beings don't generally satisfy their needs through direct activity. Even peasant society, farming society, is a process of social cooperation. So it's not one individual going to the forest and gathering trees and making a house. It's rather a more complicated form of social cooperation and social organization. And so a second premise of historical materialism would be that individuals, groups, satisfy their material needs by creating material institutions, by creating material practices and forms of knowledge and forms of cooperation through which they take the resources of nature and transform them into the goods which satisfy human needs. And now we can zoom forward to large-scale society. Marx's point is that every society consists of a system of production and a system of distribution of material goods for use by members. Furthermore, societies generally produce a surplus of material goods, a surplus of wealth. And finally, that surplus is generally captured by someone, maybe by government, which I mentioned here, maybe by private property holders, maybe by an elite religious class, but a central idea of Marx's is that the material institutions generate a surplus and the social institutions allow some group to struggle to capture the social surplus in the form of rent, taxes, contributions of various kinds, religious contributions maybe. So the framework is that facts about the social and technical properties of the production process, facts about the social and technical properties of the production process of a society, quote, determine. The reason I put that in quotes is it's problematic. We have to focus on that idea of determine. But the technical properties of the production process determine the properties of non-economic institutions, the state, ideology, culture, and so forth. So that's the most general statement. Marx also offers a view that history comes in a series of distinct stages of development. So he talks about the term that he uses is Oriental despotism, by which he refers to really the great civilizations of China and India as being stagnant. He then refers to the primitive hunter-gatherer society, classical slavery, the Roman system, feudalism, European feudalism, capitalism, and post-capitalism. And then he sees history as the unfolding or the development from one stage to the next. You will notice on your slides that I've added a sentence here. This is a bad theory. This idea of a kind of necessary sequence of stages of historical development, if there's anything that's really bogus, really just not at all convincing about Marxism today, it's this idea that history is a series of modes of production. The alternative that I would offer to you is the idea of plasticity, kind of changeability, and contingency, that there are massive contingencies in economic and political development. Therefore, the idea that ancient slavery leads necessarily to feudalism, and feudalism leads necessarily to capitalism, those inferences are just unjustified. There's not a social science basis for making those assertions. Here's another question we can ask about historical materialism. What kind of theory is it? Is it, for example, a philosophical theory? Hegel, in his philosophy of history, he's the person who actually probably most explicitly had a philosophy of history. And Hegel looks at all of human history from a kind of conceptual or ideational point of view. He understands, his statement is that history is the unfolding of stages of human freedom. So Hegel believes that history is the unfolding of the concept of human freedom. That's a philosophical theory, and I think not a very credible theory, but we might then ask, is Marx's theory of historical materialism just another philosophical, speculative theory of history? And you might think that because Marx says at some point, I turned Hegel on his head. I inverted Hegel's philosophy of history. Instead of putting ideas as the driver, I put material factors as the driver. So you might think it's really a philosophical theory. To the extent that that were true, I would say that makes it not very interesting, because speculative philosophy is not a good guide to understanding either history or social life. So if it's a philosophical theory, then I would say it's not of much intellectual interest. Second possibility, though, is it an empirical theory of human social development? Is it a theory of the way in which institutions actually develop between, now here I'll use a word that I don't like very much, dialectic. I personally think that Marx does not have a dialectical theory, because a dialectical theory is a philosophical theory, and philosophy cannot tell us how the world is. Philosophy can observe about the world, but it cannot tell us how the world develops. And so if you thought that dialectical logic explained history, then again, I would accuse you of being speculative rather than being empirical. But maybe Marx's theory is an empirical theory, one which says here are the most basic factors. They are factors about the forces of production and the relations of production, and then history unfolds as a result of the interaction between forces and relations of production. Directly empirical, in other words. The analogy here might be with biology, where you might say evolutionary biology or developmental biology is an empirical description of the development of more and more complex organisms. You might say something like that. I'm not sure it would be a correct thing to say. But an empirical theory would be one that directly observes. A third possibility, which is one that I find more compelling, is the idea that historical materialism is an intellectual research framework. It's not specifically an empirical statement, but it's also not just a philosophical speculative theory. Instead, it is a set of hypotheses about, it's sort of guesses really, about which factors are likely to turn out to be causally the most important in historical change. So a research framework is a set of ideas and guidelines and rules of thumb about where to look for good hypotheses about change. And I'm kind of advocating to you that historical materialism is more like that than it is an empirical theory or a philosophical theory. And if this approach is correct, then we should look at historical materialism as being a kind of loose framework, a kind of point of view, an intellectual point of view, within the context of which historians and social scientists who are doing more specific inquiry can kind of orient their thinking. Now, I hope that you've now read my short essay called Marxism and Method. I hope you got a chance to read that. And in that essay, I try to kind of distinguish between Marx's theory of capitalism and his writings about history. But this idea of an intellectual research framework is one of the guiding notions there. So let's see what kind of framework that is. It is the idea that, I'm looking at the third bullet here, it's focused on the forces and relations of production. What Marx is basically asserting is that social change and social organization, right at the core of those processes of change, are facts about the forces of production and facts about the relations of production. And so I'd like to take a couple of minutes in kind of developing what are the forces of production, what are the relations of production, and what is the relation between them. The forces of production, it's a simple concept. It is the idea that in order to produce anything, we need to have access to technology, to tools, to practical skills, practical kind of acquired skills and practices, and we need to have access to resources. So the forces of production include resources, natural resources, labor skills, machinery, technology. All of that constitutes the forces of production. But, of course, it is Marx's observation that if you just put a big pile of forces of production in front of an undifferentiated population, it doesn't work. You need to have a social order within the context of which the forces of production are organized and utilized for cooperative, productive purpose. And so the relations of production are the social relations which determine how the forces of production are utilized. And right at the center of that concept is the concept of property. What are the property relations which determine how and when different individuals get to make use of the forces of production. And we can think of two or three different systems, kind of instantly. We could have a concept of collective property, for example. We could have the view all of the productive wealth of society is owned by all of society. And then the decision-making about how that productive wealth is used is made collectively and democratically. That would be a form of social property. So it would say, you have a forest, you have a mine, how are those things used for productive purposes? It's up to the whole of society to decide, and they will do that through some kind of political process. That might sound a little bit familiar because it sounds like a communist view, a view of the ownership of property being by the collectivity, by everyone. Private property, a different concept altogether. The idea that individuals and small groups own resources, and what that means is they can exclude other people from the use of those resources. So private ownership of the means of production, private ownership of property and wealth would be a second form of social property. Associated with private ownership of the forces of production is the question, how is labor organized? And again, there are different ways in which labor might be organized. You might have a single czar who is the person who dispatches everyone to his place of work. So you might have the czar in the labor ministry who says, you are a miner, you are a peasant, you are an intellectual, you will be spending your days cleaning the streets in Beijing, and so forth. That would be centralized control of labor. Another possibility is serfdom. Serfdom is also a form of labor control. And according to the property requirements of serfdom, the lord determines at least part of the working day for the serf. The system of labor usage, labor organization that Marx finds within capitalism is what he calls free labor or wage labor. It is the idea that I am the controller of my labor power, no one else is the controller, and that I have the right and the need to sell my labor power to other people who want to buy my labor power. So private wage labor would be a third possible alternative. It is Marx's point that each of those variants of property and labor, each of those variants fit together into an institutional complex, and each of those institutional complexes have a very different kind of signature, a very different pattern of social working. So that feudalism has a very different economic and social logic than does classical slavery, or capitalism, or the many other forms of social and economic organizations exist. So far we've talked about technology, we've talked about the production relations, the property relations, the relations of domination and control. Marx now is taking an x-ray of society from a slightly different perspective. He's asking, what are the relations that actually determine whether and when individuals perform labor and make choices. In other words, what are the relations of power and control that exist within a given society? And again, we can think about classical slavery, where the relations of power are that the slave owner has complete and unquestioned power over the slave. Serfdom, a different set of power and control relations. Capitalism, a different set of power and control relations, and so forth. So relations of domination and control, but also relations of surplus extraction. Each of those orders, social orders, classical slavery, peasant production, feudalism, capitalism, in each case, they represent the property relations, create a system in which social surplus is appropriated by some minority class. And we can tell that story again. The serf performs half of his labor time is performed directly for the lord. And so the lord is able to take basically half the serf's product as his own product. In slavery, the slave works entirely for the master, but the master has the responsibility of feeding the slave. So only a part of the labor time of the slave is actually expropriated as surplus, but that would be the surplus extraction of slavery. Capitalism, we'll talk more the next time about how capitalism works as a system of surplus extraction, but it's Marx's central point within historical materialism, or one of three central points anyway, that in order to understand how the society works, we need to figure out how does surplus extraction work. And even in a social democracy, even in a socialist democracy, there will be surplus extraction. Because the state will extract taxes in order to run its operations. Now, would we call that exploitation, or would we just call it a fair payment by the individual citizen for the services rendered by the state? Well, that's a question that we could be debating. But even a socialist democracy is a system where surplus is being concentrated and aggregated and then extracted through a tax system. So the point about the forces of production then, that the forms of technology that are existent within a given society, these are the basis on which society produces the goods needed to satisfy the needs of the population. And this is a nice quote from the revolutions of 1848, which just really kind of summarizes the many forms that the forces of production take. Relations of production, the social relations of power and authority through which the forces of production are utilized, organized, and enjoyed. Now that definition actually involves both the coordination of the use of the forces of production, how the labor of many people are organized and supervised, but also the distribution part, the enjoyment part, that's the surplus extraction part. If there is a substantial difference between the income which flows to the owner of a factory and the income that flows to the typical worker, then the enjoyment of the forces of production is very different and very unequal. And again, Marx's sociological observation is that these relations of power and authority, these relations of property and surplus extraction, these are very dynamic, very active in the organization of society. So his advice to the sociologist, to the young sociologist, his advice to the young science of sociology, which, by the way, was only invented in the 19th century, late in the 19th century, in fact. So we could say Marx is really one of the originators of the science of sociology. But his advice to the young sociologist of social arrangements is look to the relations of power and authority through which labor time is organized and surplus is extracted. Now, why should you look there specifically? Well, it's because those are the places where social contact and social conflict are most likely. The worker, on the one hand, has an interest in having as much wage, having as much enjoyment of the fruits of cooperation as possible, and those who are more powerful in society have an interest in dominating, controlling, and extracting. And so we should expect a kind of pull and push between the powerful and the less powerful. this leads us directly then to the idea of class conflict and the idea that history is a series of conflicts between those who do not possess substantial property and those who do. It is a conflict over the social relations of production through which a minority class is capable of organizing the labor time and efforts of other people and then extracting their surplus. Marx believes that these classes invariably represent a profound and irresolvable conflict of interest between the dominant class and a producing class. Now again, remember the slide in which I asked philosophical theory, empirical theory, or research program. I would say this is a statement of a research program. It's not justified on the basis of, you know, philosophical necessity. It's also not justified as a simple generalization about stages. It's rather to say, as a kind of gifted, insightful sociologist and interpreter of society, look for the institutions through which labor is organized and advantage is taken, surplus is extracted. So he also believes, now this is the more optimistic part of Marx's writing, that he believes that members of classes, whether they're serfs or slaves or industrial workers, they will come to recognize the interests that they have in common, and they will then begin actually to join organizations which can exert power, whether they're, you know, here is about environment, it might be about labor conditions, might be about the freedom to organize, whatever, that members of classes will come to recognize their interests collectively. Coming back to a point that was made earlier in the first lecture, the point that individuals are both shaped by social institutions, but also are themselves causes of change within the social institutions. The concept of the superstructure, Marx, it's a funny concept, really. It's a concept I'm not real comfortable with because it implies a kind of mechanical separation between the economic structure of society and the superstructure, meaning the state, culture, and all other institutions. That seems to me like a false dichotomy. We might instead have a picture or an architecture which is institutions of power and relationship kind of extending throughout, which mix economic, social, cultural. But we might also say the economic and the property relations always have kind of a highlight. They always have an important prominence, and we need to pay close attention to those. A question that I would ask of historical materialism, does Marx deny that there are historical alternatives, that there are different ways of organizing a society at a given stage of development of labor and technology? Does Marx deny that? I think Marx does deny that, but I think that the theory of historical materialism should not and is not obligated to do that. Instead, I think it is perfectly consistent to put forward a conception of historical materialism that says, look to the relations of power and domination, but understand there are different configurations through which domination can occur, and therefore there are historical alternatives to the development of any particular social order. Another big issue, if one took the idea, the kind of stages of historical development idea, the stages, sequence of modes of production idea, totally seriously, if one took the view that the state exists to serve the interests of the bourgeoisie, which is a kind of crude statement of materialism, the state, a part of the superstructure, exists to serve the interests of the owning class. If you took that view entirely consistently, then things like social democracy or fascism, those political forms would be very difficult to understand, because fascism is dictatorship by a political minority over all of society, including the owning class. So that seems inconsistent. And social democracy is a political order in which the state exists, at least in part, to serve the interests of the people as well as the interests of corporations and other organizations. In other words, social democracy seems to be a political order which is more balanced between the propertied and the propertyless. So if the, you know, that strict view of the development of modes of production were, if we really stuck with that, then we would have these these difficult intellectual problems of explaining the emergence of fascism and the emergence of social democracy in the 20th century. Now, it is actually very interesting that in the 1960s, Marxist political scientists, especially in Europe, took that question very seriously. How could it be that there are such wide differences in capitalist states, from representative democracies to fascist dictatorships? How could there be that range of states all consistent with the same mode of production? And so people like Nikos Poulantzas, French political scientist, also Althusser, the French Marxist philosopher, tried to address that question of how different states were consistent with the capitalist order. We're now coming back to the word determination. The economic structure determines the superstructure. What does that mean? Does it mean that the economic structure causally determines? Well, I think we just gave examples that show that that can't be correct, because there are different states all compatible with the same economic structure. Is it a functional relationship? Well, that's functional means, is the state adjusted so as to serve the functional needs of the economic structure? That's the view that Gerald Cohen, the English philosopher, puts forward. And in my writings, I kind of criticize his view, because we need, if we're asserting a functional relationship between the state and the economic structure, we need to have an account of the social mechanisms, or the micro foundations, by which the properties of the state are adjusted so as to serve the interests of the economic structure. And we don't actually have a good theory of how that would be. We're going to finish this in about 2 minutes, but I'm not going to let technology dictate how I do that. Is Marx a technological determinist? That is, does he believe that progress in the forces of production causes all other kinds of historical change? That's an important question. In the end, I believe he is not a technological determinist. Another alternative is the idea of being an economic determinist. Does Marx believe that the property relations are actually the motor of history? Are they the engine? Are they the propelling force within historical change? So technological determinism says that development of the forces of production is the most basic historical determinant. Economic determinism says that the property relations are the most basic determinant. Or, my preferred alternative, does he look at technology and property as an interlocking set of factors, each of which constrains and propels the other, leading as a system to changes in all other aspects of society? In other words, is it a back and forth development where technology pushes relations of production, which in turn pushes technology development? I think that is correct. And now these are the concluding couple of slides. What is the status of historical materialism? I put it forward, as I suggested right at the beginning, it is best understood as a research program, a guide for future research that may turn out to be fruitful or unfruitful. It is not directly confirmed or refuted. It's not the kind of theory that should be directly confirmed or refuted. It's rather a theory that would be supported to the extent that good, fruitful historical investigation proceeds on its basis. And the research program gives us a couple of pieces of advice. It says, look for the material institutions of society. Examine non-material institutions from the point of view of their role within the total social system, and examine the nature of intergroup exploitation, the schemes of domination that these require, and the forms of struggle that result. These are three kind of research pieces of advice to the historical social scientist that come out of historical materialism. Fourth, pay attention to the lived experience of persons within social institutions. examined the centrality of class structures, exploitation, behavior, and incentive, and then finally identify enduring structures through which activities of individual are channeled. So the theory of historical materialism can be understood as a series of kind of pieces of advice for other historians and other historical sociologists. So my account would say that historical materialism is a paradigm, or it is a research tradition, and it is not directly to be directly tested, but rather evaluated in terms of the quality and insightfulness of the research that follows in that framework. So that's what I have to say about historical materialism. What do you think? It's a kind of a non-dogmatic approach. It doesn't assert, well, Marxism understands history, so all we need to do is read Marxism, we will understand history too. Rather, what it says is Marxism has some important insights into some of the social mechanisms. That actually connects to the first talk, some of the social causal mechanisms which lead to social change. And by looking to those particular mechanisms, we've got at least a start on explaining historical outcomes. How do you think this would, is there a kind of a relevance of this approach? Just take a look at the last two slides, the advice to historical social scientists. Now, being Chinese people, and being social scientists, is this helpful for understanding China today, do you think? Look to, yeah, go ahead. Is it helpful? Is a social science study of China today made more productive by following some of this advice?
We are all very familiar with this theory, mm-hmm. you know, studying in our senior school.
Right.
I mean, yeah, senior
school. Right, I do, yeah.
Before high school.
Yeah. Oh, before high school. So it's high school, really.
Junior high school. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And we'll take two examinations.
Right.
And the production mode. The force of production and the relations of production, we are all so familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the five stages of history are deeply in our thoughts. And I wonder, what do you think the stages of history should be?
That's great. And my answer to that question, so the question is, how do I think history should be divided into stages? My answer is, it should not be divided into stages. That there's way more contingency and plasticity in historical development. So it is true that classical slavery existed in Rome. It is true that classical slavery collapsed and feudalism emerged. So classical slavery, feudalism, but it is not true, according to me, it is not true that there was a necessary transition from slavery to feudalism. It is rather an accident of history that feudalism was next. Feudalism could have come before, could have come after, it could never have happened at all. Now, if we want to explain why feudalism occurred after slavery, then, you know, there are things we can say that pertain to the conditions of the late Roman Empire. But I do not think that there's any basis for asserting that there's a necessary sequence of stages. Or in other words, what I would say is you could draw a little bit of a tree here, and you could say, if we just start with Roman slavery, Roman slavery did, in fact, was followed by European feudalism. But with just a few variables changed, it could have been followed by effective in Europe. And peasant farming. In other words, here's an alternative that could have developed in Europe after the collapse of Rome. It didn't develop for another 1,000 years, but it could have developed. That's my assertion. Effective state in Europe with a peasant farming economy. Like China, exactly. Right. Europe could have looked like China. That's an assertion that I would make. I don't know. You could now challenge that and say, well, that's ridiculous. How could that possibly be? The conditions for establishing an empire with real, you know, kind of effective use of power didn't exist. You might say that. But we could have an argument back and forth. So, in other words, what I'm saying is there's a huge amount of plasticity and contingency in historical development and historical arrangements. There's something that Marxists in my country used to say. There were a few. They used to say, Marx thought capitalism inevitably leads to socialism. But actually, it's more complicated than that. Capitalism leads either to socialism or barbarism. Barbarism, barbaric, basically a savage, totalitarian, horrifying regime. So the some Marxist thinkers in the 1960s and 70s said, no, Marx was incorrect in thinking socialism is the necessary consequence of capitalism. Instead, there's the other possibility, which is barbarism. Maybe it's Nazism. Maybe it's military dictatorship for 1,000 years. There are alternatives. They're just really bad alternatives. And so, according to those Marxist thinkers, we should be doing everything we can to make this transition rather than that transition. I'm not offering an opinion there. All I'm saying is there are historical alternatives. That phrase, I love that phrase, historical alternatives. Look for the historical alternative. Look for the alternative social arrangements which were consistent at a certain period of time. An author whose work I liked quite a lot, and he's mentioned in the bibliographies multiple times. Is there another board underneath there? No. I'd hate to break everything in this room. Is Charles Tilly. Charles Tilly is an American sociologist who studies two things. He studies mobilization of people, peasants, in France, but he also studies the creation and formation of centralized absolutist state it's the transitions that you are interested in the 16th century, 17th century, 18th century. One of the things that Tilly asserts is that from the Middle Ages in Europe, where we went from basically very weak states, inconsequential states, to a large number of relatively weak states. Tilly believes that at that transition, there was a different alternative, which was more like the Chinese alternative, which was one massive, reasonably effective European state, that the whole landmass of Western Europe could have been one state. And he argues that there were very specific factors that pushed in the direction of multiple weak states rather than one reasonably strong state. It's just an interesting example of how historical sociologists have advocated for alternative pathways of development. I like that phrase. I would even write it down. Alternative pathways of development. That's a good phrase. Because what it says is at any given time, there are different historical trajectories which could be manifest. It's true for China today. That's an interesting point. That China, you might say, could develop in the direction of greater central political power, or it could conceivably develop in other directions as well. Okay, what else do you think? You were saying that you're all familiar with these premises of historical materialism, and what I'm saying to you is, let's intellectually evaluate those premises, and let's see whether we find them fruitful or not fruitful. you know, upcoming, fruitful meaning conducive to coming up with new and smart ideas about historical change, or is it just catechism, just reading the Bible, just, you know, more talk, but not helpful, not good advice? What I'm saying about historical materialism, I'm, you know, sort of expressing my own opinion, historical materialism should be thought about freshly. That was the point about the previous lecture, yesterday, Tuesday. Thought about freshly, but if you think about it not dogmatically, questioning the assumptions, then I would say there are some really, you know, kind of powerful pieces of social science advice, and it can be helpful for understanding China. It's hard advice, though, and I frankly kind of doubt that there would be governmental comfort with the idea of a real materialist analysis of China, because a materialist analysis of China would say, where is the surplus extraction happening? What is the class which is extracting surplus? And that would not be a comfortable question to ask or answer, I don't think. So in other words, it's a dynamic theory. It's a theory that forces you to question a lot of things, and you know, some of those questions might be uncomfortable questions.
We are infused, we are taught by this theory in our middle school.
Right.
But after we graduate from middle school and we enter college or university, this kind of theory, Marxist theory, become a kind of automotive.
Right.
For example, in our department, history department, there are fewer and fewer teachers, professors, and students who use this kind of theory.
Mm-hmm.
I think that automotive.
It's old-fashioned.
Yeah. Old-fashioned.
Yeah.
Well, on another hand, because this is a kind of state ideology, we have another Marxist.
College. Yes.
Which will teach continuous teaching
dogmas. Dogmas. So that's the point that I'm kind of wanting to get us the question. If you put the dogma aside, and you just ask, what are these kind of central insights that Marx brings to the study of society? What I would say basically is they're really revolutionary ideas. I don't mean in the sense of political revolution. I mean in the sense of asking very tough questions of the powerful. If you took a materialist analysis of politics and society and property for modern India or modern China, you would ask some very tough questions that would make the powerful very uncomfortable. So in other words, far from being old-fashioned dogma, you might say it's too hot, it's too dangerous to really think seriously about these ideas. I was about to say that being a huge, outspoken advocate for democracy in China today is probably not a real good career strategy. You really, you know, speaking the language of go democracy, yay democracy, that's probably kind of a dangerous intellectual strategy. But I guess I'm kind of putting it forward, being a real historical materialist would also be a somewhat hazardous, it would be a controversial point of view, because it would be to say, look to the social relations of production, look to the way that the state supports some interests and opposes other interests, look to the hidden structure of Chinese society and then write some theories about that. That's powerful and insidious advice, I think. Okay, let's take a little break, 10 minutes, and we've got justice on the agenda for the third lecture today, so that is very cool. Going to talk about justice.